The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is the first day of this seven-day sesshin here in October 2014 at Mountain Gate. And we are poised on the at the beginning of being able to add on to our current building. Yesterday, some neighbors came and laid out the lines for the addition as it extends out the end of the hallway. And tomorrow morning, the county planner, zoning and planning person, is going to come up, he says, and take a look at it and hopefully give it his approval. It's all within the appropriate limits. And so then as soon as he is finished okaying the plans, which he says will probably be Monday, then we can go down and take the plans to Construction Industry Division of the State of New Mexico, which is the next stop in this process of working it through all the planning and zoning approvals to get the building permit. And we're a little bit up against the weather because it is chilly these days, and at any moment it could end up with sub-freezing temperatures on a regular basis, which is not the best time to pour concrete. But we can't rush it. We have been gifted these wonderful plans, this beautiful design, and we need to be patient and let it take its appropriate timing so that things go well. Today, and probably for the rest of sesshin, I'd like to share with you some new translations of Hakuin's writings by the premier translator of Hakuin, Norman Waddell. This is from a brand new book that has just come out called Poison Blossoms from a Thicket of Thorn. Hakuin and other Zen masters from Japan or Japanese Zen masters have a very, very poetic way of entitling their writings. The Path to Bodhidharma, second book of Harada Shoro Roshi, for example. And here we have Poison Blossoms from a Thicket of Thorn. The idea being that these are deep teachings that will root out any ego attachment, and they are death to the ego. The ego, of course, not being the psychological ego, but the ego being the term used in modern Zen for attachment to this idea that we are somebody in particular. Harking back to some of the teachings of modern Westerners who are both psychologists and practice Zen, it's important to recognize that one has to have an ego in order to lose an ego. And so one must be healthy mentally, emotionally to do these practices. Otherwise, it doesn't work out so very well. However, most of us are full of ourselves and live a life pain and suffering caused by this attachment, because we knee-jerk react whenever anybody appears to threaten this self-image, appears to insult it, appears to embarrass it, and then we react out of our attachment to it and do and say unfortunate things and end up creating more pain and suffering for ourselves and for others. And to see through this attachment, to see through this idea that we are somebody, which really is an accumulation of conditioning. When when we're small children, we're already starting to be conditioned. We have somebody say something to us or frown at us or smile at us or otherwise engage in us, and we draw conclusions about ourselves as a result of that interaction. And then that piles on more conclusions. We go to school and the teachers have their own sets of interactions with us, and personnel conflicts come into play, and all manner of things happen, and that adds to the stew. And as we grow up, it's amazing that we grow up without more pain and suffering because we're so attached to this false idea of who we are. Who we really are is very different. And when we can open to that truth, we become much more free of this false idea of who we are. So, Hawkwind was a master at helping people see the truth. And it's typical Zen practice, or typical Zen language, to use a great deal of impressive vocabulary, such as poison blossoms from a thicket of thorn, etc., to communicate that. And I'd like to share with you one of the translations today in this book. This is Instructions from the Teaching Seat at a Vegetarian Feast, Senior Monk Yaku held for his deceased father. There's a little introduction here. Senior Monk Yaku, or Yaku Joza, Joza meaning senior monk, full name Don Sen Genyaku, and there's no dates for him, from Bungo Province on the island of Kyushu, arrived at Shoinji after having experienced a strong Satori. Hakuin soon disabused him of the notion that his training was over, and he stayed on to engage in post-Satori training. And here I would like to say something about this post-Satori training. Hakuin emphasized it, so did his Dharma successor, his first Dharma successor, Tori Inji. And then somehow it kind of got forgotten along the way and has not been emphasized to speak of in American Zen, unfortunately. And for this reason, we have had some of the abuses of Zen teachers we've been experiencing recently. It's vital to continue your Zen practice, deepening seriously with great commitment, until it's no longer possible to practice because you've gotten so old and infirm, or you've gotten Alzheimer's, or you've died. It's not obvious in any way that I've been able to find out that there is an end to Zen practice. And Dogen, who's lauded as the founder of the Soto Zen sect in Japan, even says there's no beginning to enlightenment, no end to training. No beginning to training, no end to enlightenment. We just keep on going. When we stop and think about the stories of the Buddha, the Jataka tales are the purported past lives of the Buddha in which he was deeply, seriously training himself, lifetime after lifetime, culminating in the one in which he continued his training for 6 years and then sat down under the Bodhi tree and had a great enlightenment experience. And we can't say that he quit his training then either, because in each moment he was expiating karma as soon as it was beginning to be formed. And this is very important, that even the Buddha didn't stop training. So why do we think we might be important enough or enlightened enough that we should or could? Continuing, this is again about Monk Yaku. He took up residence in Kanonji on the eastern outskirts of Hara and commuted to Shoinji, which was where Hakuin was teaching, for Sanzen with the master. Yaku later became head priest at Chushoji in Kawachi province, south of Osaka. The deceased father, on whose behalf he provided the vegetarian feast, is referred to by his posthumous name, Teion Sempojoza. The suffix Joza, which means senior priest, though usually reserved for clerics' posthumous titles, was on occasion given to lay followers as well, sometimes in conjunction with a deathbed ordination. The piece is dated 1745, Hakuin's 60th year. Yaku appears three times in Hakuin's chronological biography in the capacity of a temple steward during lectures on the record of Sutan, as a supervising priest at a lecture meeting on the Vimalakirti Sutra, and in an episode in which he submits an enlightenment verse to Hakuin, which is alluded to below. Hakuin apparently thought highly of Yaku's literary skills, since he entrusted him with the editing of his lectures on the record of Sutan, his first publication, and also had him write the preface for it. And so here is Hakuin's talk. Don't go hanging out any calabashes. People will only laugh if you do. Reference to this is that when merchants had vinegar for sale, they would hang out a calabash, and that signified that they've got good vinegar sale. In other words, he's telling Monk Yaku, don't get a swelled head about this. You may have had some insight, but this is not the end. People will only laugh at you if you do. When the yellow dragon's blind eyes opened for the first time and he peered dimly around, wasn't he met with howling laughter? And that refers to a monk, Huinan. His enlightenment, it turns out, was sanctioned rather quickly and a little bit prematurely, it turns out. And he was later, it says, humbled in an encounter with Master Tzu Ming. So, don't get any ideas that you've had something important happen to you. And Hakuin is talking about his own experience here as well. And he had his first Kensho experience at the age of 23 on hearing the temple bell during a series of temple lectures. He thought that he had had the most fantastic and deep awakening experience anybody had ever had in several hundred years. And it wasn't until he got to Dokyo Eitan's small hermitage that Dokyo Eitan was able to convince him that it was quite short of the truth. And under Dokyo Eitan, he came to deeper and deeper awakening and genuine awakening. Not that the first one wasn't genuine, but it wasn't as big as Hakuin thought it was. And he certainly needed to continue with post-Satori training, which he did under Dokyo Eitan and continued as well even after he left Dokyo Eitan's hermitage. He left Dokyo Eitan not because he wanted to stop his training or leave his training, but because the monks that he had traveled with to the lecture series from which he left to go to Dokyo Eitan's place had figured out where he was and caught up with him. And Hakuin knew that these monks were not quite as serious as would be appropriate to train with Dokyo Eitan, and that they would just make themselves a nuisance and probably tear up the garden camping in it. And so Hakuin reluctantly left in order to draw those less than 100% committed monks away from Dokyo Eitan. But he continued to question Dokyo Eitan's other Dharma successor, who unfortunately died young, on certain koans, and he continued to chew on them and break through in them. And he finally had a decisive awakening experience many, many years later. And it says that he was continuing his practice, and this is vital. And he continues, Senior monk Yaku from Bungo province began his religious training at a certain temple, achieving a significant breakthrough that filled him with strength. He was all ready to cease his training and begin sweeping the Zen world clean from top to bottom. In spring of the fifth year of Genbun, which would have been 1740, Yaku strode into my Dharma's precincts with a cocky, self-confident air. He wore a battered sedge hat and was dragging a large staff he'd wrenched off a wisteria bush somewhere. He looked like an old crane stalking through a flock of chickens. My monks rubbed their eyes and stared enviously. I took a quick glance at him and tested him with a line of ordinary dialogue. It knocked him right back. His Zen function was dull and sluggish, incapable of turning and responding freely and easily. This was completely contrary to the reports I had been getting about him. I told him, now that I see you face to face, you're not quite what I'd been led to expect. From that time on, I assaulted him with endless sallies of stinging invective, assailed him with deafening shouts. I was merciless. I didn't let up on him for a second. In doing this, Hakuin is giving him the same treatment that Dokyue Dan gave Hakuin under more or less the same circumstances. Yaku decided to hang up his traveling staff for good and stay on at Shoinji as my student. He would come to me for sons and mornings and evenings, his head lowered in shame. He would run off afterwards, his bugged-out eyes filled with tears. But he bore down, spurred on by the burning indignation he felt towards priests like Cheng San Seng and Qing Fen, men who had prematurely confirmed their students' enlightenment. Before long, he gave up both eating and sleeping, was oblivious to hunger and cold. In autumn of the second year of Kampo, that would be 1742, I went in response to a request from Ryotanji in Totomi province to conduct a Dharma meeting. All the Shoinji monks except Yaku accompanied me on the trip. He was in too sorry a state to travel. During the month we were away, Yaku continued to bore his way into the story of Cheng Feng's three kinds of infirmity. And suddenly the prison walls fell away and he was free. Knowing that I was on my way back from Ryutanji, he set out from Shoinji and made his way down the Tokaido to meet my palanquin. He waylaid me on the road, holding out a verse he had written, expressing the understanding it achieved. I took one glance at it and began assailing him angrily, using even stronger abuse than before. As Yaku walked back to Shoinji with us, he kept scratching his head. Deep creases lined his brow. 3 years later, Yaku achieved another sudden breakthrough. This time, he managed to stumble up into the foothills to the left of Eastern Mountain. This was a reference to an ancient Chinese priest who lived there. But I still wasn't happy, and he wasn't really satisfied either. And that would be to his credit. He was fired by a burning aspiration that could not be held back. This was of vital importance to the assembly, firing up the younger monks around him and spurning them to greater effort. This year, the second of Enkyo, 1745, is the seventh anniversary of his father Teon Senpojoza's death. Senior monk Yaku empties his purse of the few coins it contained and said, I would like you to hold a ceremony for my deceased father. There's no need to chant sutras or dharanis. What I want is for you and your great compassion to raise up the Zen teachings, to utter a phrase or two, one of those impenetrable adamantine cages or prickly chestnut burrs for the sake of the many cold starving monks practicing here at Shoinji. The reference to impenetrable adamantine cages or prickly chestnut burrs is to koans or statements that are impossible, it seems, to comprehend. And yet, if they're chewed upon deeply enough, they can awaken a person. I thought of Kwan To Che penetrating the koan at Tsinghua, striking supervisor Monk Kopin, and dreaming that very night of his mother, who told him that owing to his attainment she'd gained rebirth in the Deva realms, where she could hear the compassionate teachings of the Bodhisattvas. Master Dahui of the Qingshan Monastery was deeply moved by this story. When accumulation of merit from deep faith and devotion to practice results in the attainment of prajna wisdom, he said, it is something truly beyond our comprehension. How can there be a single doubt that Tayan Sempo Joza will be delighted beyond measure in the other world to learn that his son, senior monk Yaku, has achieved? It is because of this that I agreed to the senior priest's request and offered these words. Will it perhaps be a case of offering a great reward and waiting for a valiant man to appear? Senior monk Yaku certainly worked hard. There's reference to him not eating and not sleeping. To go into that to a certain degree can be very helpful. But Hakuin found himself, and so did his student Tore Inji, in a kind of nervous sickness that the doctors gave up on him, both of them, about when they worked in that striving way. If we naturally forget to eat because we're so deeply involved in this inner search, if we forget to sleep because we're so deeply involved in this inner search, that's not the same. But if we're striving to come to awakening or to deepen an awakening, and we purposely stop eating and purposely stop sleeping, then that has a little different tinge to it. There's a Chinese story of the monk who decided to sit zazen. He was out I think he was in a hermitage, and he decided to sit zazen while his breakfast cereal was cooking. And he went into a deep samadhi, which is a natural state of absorption. And when he came out of it, he discovered that the fire had long gone out and the cereal had grown mold. So he was naturally in that state of samadhi, deeply absorbed in his practice for presumably many days. That's a natural situation. But to try to force ourselves into some kind of ideal mind state, you have to be careful about that. It's more about allowing the mind to rest and plunge deeply within, sinking deeper and deeper and deeper into our heart, into the depths of our mind, on a single-minded quest for who and what we are, for that deep, profound truth that will free us once realized, for that true home, to follow that yearning to return home deep within and allow it to take us where it does. That is very different. So we have to be a little bit careful in our practice. If it naturally comes to doing many late nights, that's one thing. It's a balance. This practice is the middle way. We need to move beyond our comfort zone, that's for sure. Unfortunately, I can't say where that is or how far one should go. But if we're naturally led deep within, then go there. You see that Hakuin truly emphasized the importance of continuing practice well beyond a first Kensho experience. And this is absolutely true. It's not sufficient to stop with one Kensho. We need to continue our practice and broaden and deepen the opening that we have achieved in that initial Kensho and take it far, far deeper until there is nothing left till we truly have seen to the very bottom. And that can take lifetimes. But that we are on the way is important, vital. That we are so committed that we come to Sesshin is equally vital. It cannot be emphasized how important this is, especially in the world of suffering today. There is so much brutality, there's so much suffering, there's so much fear, there's so much anger and rage. The more Zazen we can do, the more it will help to counteract that explosive energy that seems to be rampant, even in nature, which of course follows the energy of human minds. So I think that's enough for today, and we'll stop now and recite the four vows.